This is Bob Lang, oral historian with the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Today is June 18th, 2013. This interview is the first session with Milton L. Sunday, Professor Emeritus of the Department of Animal Sciences. So, Milt, to begin the interview, if you could give us, for the record, your birth date, birthplace, and talk some about who your parents were.
Okay. My name is, of course, Milton Lester Sunday. I was named for my grandmothers, Martha and Lars was the husband, and the other was Carl, was my grandfather on the other side, and I forget the name of her, but she, so I was named that for the family.
Good.
And they came, my family come from mostly from Norway in the long run, somebody did, but it gets to be fairly complicated in that my mother's family had come over, or she was born in the United States, but in the late 1880s, and my dad had been born in Norway in 1889. Mm. And so when he was about 8 years old, there were so many kids in the family that he had to move to the neighbor. So he worked for a neighbor for his board and room after that, pretty much. And this cabin was not much of it. And I went over there in 46, 45, and I slept in the bed my dad was born in.
Really?
And it was pretty short. couldn't straighten out in it. But anyway, that's those, and that way, I met my grandmother. No, shoot. My grandmother's already dead then, but my grandfather was still alive, and then several of my uncles and aunts were still alive over there, and I got to visit with them.
Milt, how was it that they ended up in South Dakota as opposed to Minnesota or Wisconsin?
Well, I think they really went into Minnesota kind of halfway first. Uh-huh. In fact, on my grandfather's side, one of his brothers had come over in 1868, and he'd ended up in Madison, but in Windsor, and north of town here. And so he started farming, and then in 1873, he invited his brother and the brother's wife to come over, and he paid their fare for them, and they had to work for him then 2 years for the fare. Mm-hmm. And so they were here in 1873 to 75. Then my grandfather was invited to come over in 1875, and he come to Madison, Wisconsin first. Huh. But he had been in the army in Norway and learned the shoemaking business. So he became a shoemaker here in Madison from 1877 till 1875 to 1878. Then he and his brother both went to South Dakota and homesteaded out there.
I see. Was his name Sunday?
No. It was changed, but that was on my mother's side. It was Mel. M-E-H-L. M-E-L. And there's a little town in Norway. I've been there a couple times that they were named, the family was named from, and so they all took that name. And there is a guy, which I didn't know, but I went through some old stuff up there in Wanakee, which is a little town where they were nearby, and it tells about this John Mell. I believe it was John Mell. I can't remember for sure. Anyway, he had been hauling tobacco leaves to town, and his horse had run away from him, and he got injured. It was in their little newspaper thing they had there, and I have a copy of that.
Oh,
but I don't know for sure. He's my relative or not, but the name is right.
Uh-huh. So did your parents then meet and marry in South Dakota?
Yes. Yeah. My father was brought over here, and his aunt's husband paid for the fare over here to America. And then my dad had to work for him for 2 years. Uh-huh. To pay off the fare. I suppose it cost $125 or so at that time. But they would usually come into New York and then by train over to Chicago and then train on into the Midwest someplace. I don't know how that really worked. But that was the way that that's the way they got into it. And there was a, quite a collection, of course, of Norwegians in western Wisconsin and across Minnesota and then into the Dakotas, quite a bunch.
Now, how old was your father when he came over?
He was 18. He was born in, he come over in 08, and he was born in 89, so he's 19.
I see. And I assume he didn't speak any English.
Oh, no, 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 no. But of course, the families he lived with were mostly Norwegian, too, I imagine. But he went to school here. He had gotten through the eighth grade in Norway, but here he had did it in one winter, and he got up to the fourth grade in school. And I suppose he had to learn some English for that. I don't know.
So where did he meet your mother?
Well, that would have been that farm had been that where my father had gone to, was about 30 miles south near Sioux Falls, South Dakota. But then they bought a farm up north, which was about a three-quarter of a mile from where my mother was raised. And then of course, my father had come up there, and then I'm sure he knew her, too, before that. And then he was also in the service of World War One.
Oh,
and
he was?
And he was in Norway, but at that time they had a bad influenza or flu epidemic in 1918, and he happened to be one that was in the hospital at the time they made their first big attack, and there was hardly any of his company that lived. So he was, the pneumonia helped him a lot, getting by.
So then that was that famous flu epidemic.
Yes, it was quite famous. And my mother died in the next one, 10 years later, 28.
Oh, I didn't remember that there was a second.
And there's been one or some. They've had some books on it here and there. I don't remember too much about them. But.
So, for the historical record,
yeah,
it
maybe.
Is. So when do they marry and when are you born?
Oh, my dad married, I think, in 19 when he got back from Europe.
Uh-huh.
And then I was born January 7th, 1921. That's what they tell me. I can't remember anything about it. But I was born on the farm. They didn't have doctors that come. I think there was a midwife or something that come in and helped.
And are there other children in the family?
I have a brother and one sister, and they're still all alive.
Wow.
They're all younger, a little bit younger.
So, was this a pretty big farm? That your father had homesteaded?
No. My father didn't homestead. My grandfather did.
Uh-huh.
And then he also got what was called a tree claim. They could get an additional 80 acres if they planted 6 acres of trees, and there was 60% of them still alive after 4 years.
Huh.
And so he got an 80 that way.
I see.
And then that 80 was farmed with them. So they had a quarter and an 80 there. Together.
And what was it like growing up on a farm in the 1920s?
I thought it was all right at the time, I guess. I imagine I didn't like everything that happened, but you had a chance to do a lot of things that you didn't. Trapping gophers, shooting gophers eventually.
Uh-huh.
First we had to use the twine and catch them, you know.
You had to use the twine?
Twine to put it around the hole, and then when they come out and pull on the twine and catch them around the neck and then take them out and kill them.
Did you work pretty regularly on the farm?
Did you
have daily chores
sure. Yeah.
Milking?
Yes. Oh, yeah. As soon as I was fit, I had to milk, yeah. We had about 8 to 10 cows, and we'd milk morning and night. And then we had a little tank. So whenever you put the milk and cream in there, and then you fed the milk back to the pigs or the chickens.
And
after you skim milk, you skim the fat off.
Was this self-sufficient farming? Like, did you grow all your own food?
No, not all. We grew a lot. And our particular area, we were pretty big in raising potatoes.
Oh.
And so for 2 weeks in the fall, we could skip school and go pick potatoes, because most of them had to be picked by hand. And they had a digger, and it shook the dirt off, but then the potatoes would lay in pretty much a row.
You must have started to school in the mid-20s, and I think I read somewhere you went to a one-room school.
One-room school, yeah. And my brother was a little too young to go, but they thought I was supposed to be protecting him in school, so he and I were in school together, but he was a year and 4 months younger than I was. Mm-hmm. So he was pretty on the young side, and I was a little on the old side, I suppose you could say.
And as you think back on it, did you get a reasonably good education in that one-room school?
Oh, yeah. I think we got a pretty good education, yeah. And the teachers were very cooperative, and they tried to just, and we'd go to these arithmetic contest things and that kind of stuff, spelling contests and arithmetic. Well, our school always did pretty good.
Now, was this one room through sixth grade or eighth grade?
Eighth grade. Yeah.
A lot of kids in that school?
No. There were 18 when I started. And when I left after that, there were 5 kids in my class.
Oh.
And that was a pretty big class in those days. And so there were 12 after that. And then they held school for another, I suppose, 10 years there. And then it eventually closed. And then they went to school in town after that.
Milt, would you say that you were recognized early on as a pretty smart little boy?
No, I'm sure not. I'm sure not.
In terms of who you become,
yeah.
I was just curious if a teacher ever said to your parents, you know, this little boy is doing pretty well in school.
Well, if they did, I never heard anything about it.
Uh-huh.
But I always got along with the teachers just fine. You know, we had men teachers a couple times, and the rest of them were ladies all the way. But go ahead.
Did you have any particular interest, particularly of a scientific nature, when you were in that one-room schoolhouse?
No, I can't say we did anything scientific. We were watching for the geese and the ducks and stuff pretty regular. There's nothing particular. But then... about that time, they started talking about going to 4-H club stuff, and that's when we started getting more interested. But my dad was already into chickens pretty big. Before that, he had exhibition-type stuff. And so he would show those, and he showed chickens all over the Midwest, and he got to know a lot of the judges, and he also knew certain judges liked certain features of a particular chicken better than others, and so he always tried to send the birds that was the thing he thought fit in with what the judge was thinking about. And he had an awful lot of, he won a lot of money and a lot of ribbons.
How did he get so interested in chickens? Do you know?
I have no idea. No.
But he just was.
Yeah.
And so is that where you picked up your interest?
Yeah. And in 4-H, I had chickens. And he raised Buff Orpingtons. That was a buff-colored chicken. But I didn't want to be the same, so I had white Orpingtons. And I got real good hatching stock. My dad would buy hatching eggs from a guy he knew had good ones, and we would hatch them. And then I had a little chicken house that I had kept my own little flock in.
And did you enter those in contests, too?
Oh, sure. And then we got interested in judging chickens for the 4-H. And so we used to win, my brother and I and another kid won the state thing at the state fair, but we were all too young to go to the big fair down in Chicago. So I got some kind of a book on poultry. That was a gift for that. That was the best they could do for us at that time.
Where was the South Dakota State Fair held?
That would have been here in South Dakota. Uh-huh. That's west to waste. And then when I got into college, I worked there a year or two with the 4-H people. And I was superintendent of the 4-H show, chicken show.
So your involvement with chickens goes way back.
Oh, yeah, 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 yeah.
So you finish in eighth grade, and then where do you go?
Well, I stayed out a year because my dad didn't think I didn't have any reason to go to high school. And so I was stayed out 1 year, and then I went back. And then I got into Future Farmers of America with them at the high school level.
Why didn't your father want you to go on?
He didn't think those was necessary. Eighth grade is good enough for him. It's probably for me.
So why did you go?
Well, I wanted to learn more about farming from the agriculture teacher there at this place. And then I was a pretty good baseball player, so he'd got a hold of my dad and talked him into saying that I should come there to high school. Well, then I played football there, but I wasn't that good. But I was a pretty good baseball player. In fact, our little dinky town with about 200 people in it had it in this what they call Legion baseball. It was baseball for kids up to about 16. And then they'd have us. So our little dinky team played in the state tournament 1 year.
Really?
And we beat the first team. We beat Mitchell, which was a pretty big town to us. And we'd beaten Sioux Falls and Watertown. But we lost in the end to Pier South, which was the home. And they had a pretty good pitcher. We had a pretty good pitcher, too, but he couldn't pitch 2 days in a row.
And what was the name of the town that you grew up in?
Near Volga, South Dakota, out in the country there. About 10 miles from Volga and about 3 miles from this little town called Sinai. They early prior come out there, and there was a pretty good-sized hill down there. One of the guys said, well, that looks just like Mount Sinai. You know, of course, he'd never been to Mount Sinai. He didn't know what Mount Sinai looked like. But so that's where the name came from.
This is great. So the high school, was it a consolidated high school? Did it serve a lot of those little towns?
Yeah, and I'll say there's several, three, four, I suppose. Yeah, my class, I think, was 42 in the class, which is it's a pretty good size.
Did you walk or ride a bus?
No. When I went to that small school, I rode my bicycle the first 2 years to Sinai. Then the superintendent, or that guy, wanted me to play ball, so he was the one who talked my dad and I into going down to Volga. It was a bigger town.
Uh-huh.
Well, that's still a pretty small town, but bigger. And so then I stayed in town with my father's family that was there, and they lived there. And so I lived with a couple other kids in this house. They had a big house there, and we lived. That's where I stayed. Went junior and senior years there.
And as you think back on high school, any particularly significant teachers that had any kind of lasting influence on you?
Yeah, the one, the chemistry teacher, and I started messing around with chemicals at that time. But, of course, that was in high school. You didn't do too much.
Uh-huh.
As I recall, we made hydrogen sulfide and a few other states around there just to... But as you see, I was already pretty involved with the university with the college there, because the college is in Brookings, which is another 10 miles away or so from Volga, and then I was already judging chickens over there, and so I knew the professors, and my dad used to buy roosters from them too, and he bought dairy calves too. He'd buy a bull, and I remember he had a deal 1 year. He had to pay $75 if the cow, the mother, milked more than 4,000 pounds of milk, I think it was. But if it was less than 4,000 pounds, he only had to pay her $50 for the bull calf.
So if you're born in 1921, you're in high school during the Depression and the drought.
Yeah,
in the
yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah.
How did that impact you and your family?
Not too much. We didn't have much. We raised. We had a big garden, of course, and we had plenty of eggs, and we had pigs and cows. And so we butchered a pig every once in a while.
What about the drought?
Well, the droughts, yeah, that was bad. And I'll never forget my dad when we were so dry. He'd get out in the evening and see a cloud in the west. And he just hoped that damn thing had come and dump water on us. But, of course, usually they didn't. And then they would, sometimes they would split. There was a lake there fairly close. And he always thought, and I don't know, maybe he's right, that this cloud tended to split above the water. I don't know whether there's anything to it or not, but he believed that pretty since. Of course, I believed it too at that time, mm-hmm. you know, without any doubt.
But your family didn't come close to losing their
Yes, farm. My dad lost the farm.
Oh, he did.
But to Banker's Life, and since then I've never liked Banker's Life. But then there was a federal bank thing that took over the mortgage, and then and I think they lowered the payments or something. So then my dad was able to keep it that way. But I remember one night, my brother and I were up in the bedroom, and the sheriff come, and he was going to take my dad to jail because he hadn't paid for the money down at the bank. And I remember him saying, "Well, look, I got these three kids upstairs," and by that time my mother, see, had died early. She died in 28, uh-huh. And so he had to raise them. Well, he had a hired girl sell it quite often, but I remember him begging with that guy, and he finally said, "Okay, you can stay here." But that, I'm thinking, I was supposed to 10, 11, 12 then. I was like, "My God, I got to get my brother and sister up. We got to get the chores done, and we got to get to school." But fortunately, he said, "Well, okay, I guess you could stay." But it's scary.
Oh, of course it is.
Yeah.
Terribly scary.
Yeah.
So when do you graduate from high school?
It must have been 39 or 30. Oh, no. Yeah, I suppose 39 or I suppose 39. I'm not even sure.
And?
Then I was out a year, and then I went to high school.
So I
finished high school in 41, I think. I might be off in the years early there a little bit, yeah.
So you're in high school, then you take a year off,
yeah.
And then you go back to high school?
Between grade school and high school is 1 year
right.
spread. Then I started high school, and then I was able to finish high school before the war.
And were you aware that the war was coming?
No. No. I remember I was starting a freshman in college when Roosevelt talked about what we'd have to do with the war.
Is that when you were you at South Dakota State?
State, then? Yeah, yeah.
And where was South Dakota State?
In Brookings, South Dakota.
In Brookings.
It's kind of funny, when they went from being territory to a state, there were some things, there were options, and there were two different options there were people who were interested in. One was the prison system, and the other was the university, Ike's University. They already had the university at Vermilion, so Sioux Falls they were the biggest town, so they got first crack, so they took the prison because they figured there's more money in having a prison than having a college, especially an ag college.
Prison over education.
Yep. There's more money in it, I guess.
Was your dad supportive of you going on to college?
Yeah, I think he was. I think so, yep. But I think it's mainly because of the judging stuff, you see. See, both my brother and I became pretty efficient judges of chickens in this 4-H stuff. And then we won that 1 year, and all we got was we could go for it. But the next year we went to Chicago and judged. And then they had a thing in, might have been 36, I can't remember the year, the World's Poultry Meeting was meeting in the United States. And they were meeting in Cleveland. And so my brother and I there were three people on the judging team for judging chickens. And then we also had two guys that were giving a demonstration that come from South Dakota. And a county agent hauled us all the way to Columbus, Ohio. And
wow.
that's where the thing was, and my brother and I, they only gave us some, but my brother and I both were in the top 12 of the judges. There were they for the all over the world, and there must have been 150 kids judging chickens there at that time.
When you judge a chicken back then, what do you look for?
Well, you know, they look for a conformation of the body and how well the legs fit for it into it, and the head. Though they have a whole series of point systems for the eyes and the everything, but it's all that stuff. You have to take all those things. And then there are some things called disqualifications you got to look for. Like most of the people that had clear shank chickens, they didn't want any little feathers sticking out here and there. So that was a bad thing. Uh-huh. And then there was a little prongs that could come out the side of the comb instead of all the points up on top. And that was a bad thing. So there was a number of disqualifications. Certainly colored feathers that certain types would be, you'd have to, but you had to know those by the varieties and so on, so that you do in order to do it effectively. And so we'd learned that stuff pretty well.
And Milt, were chickens a profitable crop in those days?
Yeah, not too profitable, but my dad, he sold, because his breeding stock was pretty high quality, he would sell hatching eggs. I think he got $5 for a dozen, or 15, I guess, 15 eggs for one particular strain, and he would get $5 for those a dozen eggs, which
wow.
is, at that time was
good money.
Yeah, it was better than 30 cents, yeah. I think. But anyway, so he was into that pretty quite a lot.
So your first year at South Dakota State, what are you studying?
Well, I was studying mostly crop things and animal sciences and stuff like that. But I did get a scholarship from Sears Roebuck, enough to pay my tuition.
How did
much.
You get that?
I don't know. I just filed the papers in, and my grades are good in high school, of course. I think I was some of the salute something or other up there.
Were you salutatorian?
No, I don't know. I was something anyway.
Well, that is something.
Well, it helped. It helped. And I my dad couldn't support us, so I worked. I usually had two jobs. One time I was working for a banker. I sweep the bank out two nights a week and wipe and wash it good the floor and everything on one night. And then I also would take all his cinders from his furnace. And I do his sidewalks around his house too. So then I had that. Then I also had a thing where I for a lady whose sister had a restaurant in Brookings. The lady lived in this little town of Sinia, but the sister lived. And I worked for her for 2 years. And I got my meals at the restaurant for working from about 4:30 till 8:30 at night. And then on the weekends, every other weekend I had to work and do a whole weekend, but the husband and I had to wash and wax the floor after midnight.
Wow.
And so we'd wash this damn floor and then we're waking for it to dry. And he was a character. He said, "Come on, Milt, let's have a cigar." So we'd take one of the best cigars that she was selling. He says his wife was kind of running. we'd sit there and smoke those till we run out of cigar or the ground got dry, whichever.
You seem to have had fun.
Oh,
during
yeah.
your life.
Oh, sure. Then I worked at a poultry farm too some. And now, this is something I think is quite important. You probably have been reading the newspapers lately where that arsenic has got such a bad reputation.
Yes.
Well, I didn't know much about this, but when I was one of my jobs when I got to be about a sophomore in the college there was to water the chickens in the morning, and we were doing a big experiment, and I knew about the experiment with high selenium wheat. There was an area in South Dakota where it didn't rain too much, and they only got a wheat crop about every once out of 4 years. But the selenium was high, wheat was high in selenium, the seeds.
Uh-huh.
And then what had happened way, way back, this had been in the 1860s, the U.S. Army was big in South Dakota fighting the Indians.
Uh-huh.
And they found out, like a lot of people have found out since, that a man is more effective sitting on a horse than he is walking on the ground. Mm-hmm. And so they had a big cavalry unit there, and they were stationed at a place called Rosebud, west of the pier, south and west there, dry stuff. And they noticed after the horses had been there about 6 months, they began to lose their hair on their tail and on the mane. And everybody knew that was bad. Mm-hmm. And they didn't know why, but they called it alkali disease early, but they didn't know what it was from. Then by about 1900, people had found out about selenium, and they found out that the mineral that was high was selenium. And so they had then, when they got a decent wheat crop, they bought the wheat from out there, and they put it in what was called Bemis bags. These are bags that are normally used for only seed, for alfalfa seed, really high. But they hold about 2.5 bushels. And we had to horse those up and put them on a second floor room in the poultry building, because that was the only mouse poof room we had to keep them.
Yeah.
And so then they had to mix this wheat then, or this oats in with their wheat in with their various diets, and then they knew the selenium content pretty well by then, what it was. And then one of my jobs was to water the chickens. I had to put in a 10 cc's of arsenic solution for certain pens, and of course none for others, but I had into the water pail. I had to fill the water pail to a certain level on this pail and then add that stuff. And then also my job got to be to hatch the eggs that those birds laid, because we had roosters with them. And then I had to study the embryos, and I began to see the abnormal embryos with the selenium. But with the arsenic in there, everything's lovely. So, well, we do these experiments, and I think it was published by the department way back then. I wasn't aware of, but I knew what was going on. Huh. And then we had to do that. We published that stuff, and then we had some. In the end of experiments, you always have some feed left over, so the guys are going to throw that away. And I said, "No, the whites are going to throw it. I'll tell you what, we'll just feed it to one pen, and then I'll put the arsenic in the water, so they'll be all right." And we did. Lo and behold, they did just fine. But the other pens around there that weren't getting that feed, they developed coccidiosis, which is a common disease of young chickens. And so I don't know how this information came, but one of the major chemical supply for poultry people started selling phenyl arsenic acid as a treatment for coccidiosis.
Really?
Yeah. And I might still be used today. I don't know. I know it was used for a long time. But the arsenic was in there. And I really now, as I look back on it, and I think that arsenic may be an essential mineral, but at very, very low levels. Hmm. But it's funny how that would counteract the mercury toxic or the selenium toxicity.
Fascinating.
Yeah, they published some of that then, and then but I've published quite a lot of things with selenium, and I've used selenium in high mercury diets. Selenium will reduce mercury toxicity.
Really?
One time I bought a ton of walleye pike fillets from the Lake Winnipeg in Canada, because that lake was high in mercury, because there was a great big battery factory that made a hell of a lot of batteries, and the fish got the mercury got into the fish that way. Uh-huh. And we were able to counteract the mercury toxicity with selenium.
And walleye are particularly prone to collecting mercury, aren't
they? Yeah. Well, anyway, and we had to get all that old fillet and cook, and got them cooked and canned, and then we fed it to cats. And we had a big cat, which we reported.
So, Milt, this suggests to me, mm-hmm. your first couple of years at college, you're developing an interest in research?
Yeah. You get pretty interested when you realize here you're feeding something you're scared to death of.
Yeah.
And it helps. That's a little hard to swallow to start with.
But you must have been intrigued by that.
Oh,
fact,
oh sure.
Not put off.
No. I didn't. No, I don't think it bothered me. I don't think it did. If it did, I don't know.
do you finish, so what happens? Do you finish your sophomore year? When do you go into the Army?
I think I was about a junior then when I went in. But we had to sign up early I wanted to get the reserve in the reserve for a commission eventually. And so, but we went in a year ahead of time, so we never got the commissions.
I see. Were you drafted then?
No. We had to enlist a while back, and then after a year or so, they pulled us in mm-hmm. to sort of serve.
Do you remember how you were feeling about having to leave school and go into the military?
I don't know. I don't think I had much one way or another. See, I knew my dad had been in service, and I don't think I really liked it, but I don't think I felt too bad about it.
Were most of the boys going in?
Yeah, a lot of them were out of the college, yeah.
So talk a little bit about that episode, would you?
Yeah.
Where you trained and what you did?
Yeah. Well, we went to down to Texas first for initial training, for basic, they called it.
Uh-huh.
And then we went up there we were there for 18 weeks, I think. And then they were going to send us back to ASTP school. So
what is that?
It was a program for military people at the universities.
Oh.
And so we go up to Grinnell, Iowa. And we were there 4 days, but the school had been, it was a girls' school, so it was kind of closed. And then we went from there back to the university, but they weren't ready for us at Madison or at Brookings at that time. So then we were there only one semester, but not quite a full semester, because we had been in Texas in pretty good shape, all of us. And we had ASTP people around too, and we thought we were pretty tough. So when we were marching around from one class to another, if there was Air Force or other routes coming along, we didn't get out of the way. We just walked straight right through them. And they called us the 44 Kings. There were 44 of us.
Uh-huh.
And so we were together all the time then. Then one or two died in the war, or three died, I guess, maybe more. But anyway, after the war, while the guys started meeting, having a meeting just of the 44 Kings, what left of it. And so then one of the guys decided what we needed was a bottle of booze. And so he bought a bottle of booze, and it's going to be served for the guy who lived the longest. And we're now down to 8 survivors.
Do you still get together?
No, we don't get together anymore. And I knew, out of the 8, I knew 2 out of the others quite well, and a little bit of the other one. But I don't know. This is as of last January. I got a letter from somebody at the college there telling about that, and they're seeing how many people are serving, how many more. And they all get up in years, you know. They're all close to my age, I think.
So at what point, I assume you're shipped over to Europe.
Yeah. I went with the 76th Division then. After I got my commission, I went with them over to Europe. And then I was with them until the end of the war. And then I was disbanded. And that's when I joined this other outfit.
Where in Europe were you?
Well, we started out in England, of course, and then we went across into France by boat, and then from there we went up to the Bulge. That's where I started the war, was in the Bulge.
I see. So you went across the Channel after D-Day.
After D-Day, yeah.
Got caught in that awful...
Oh, yeah. What really scared the hell out of us was we went up by semi, one of those big semis with all the men in the thing, and two semi-loads, I think. And we get up into Bastogne, and one of the drivers for the drove, he said, well, I hauled 101st Division up here 3 days ago, and I hauled quite a few of them back yesterday. Dead, of course, or wounded, one or the other. That scared the hell out of us.
I'm sure it did.
Yeah.
So were you at the Battle of the Bulge for the whole time period?
Well, until we went through the Bulge, yeah. Well, see, we got in about the third day of the Bulge. That's when the Germans finally made their big push through and broke through the line.
Mm-hmm.
And then we were in Bastogne and Hoffelis. There were the places where we were right there. And then of course, then we moved up the through the Siegfried Line. That's where I got my overcoat shot up and stuff.
I don't tell me about that.
Oh, well, anyway, it was cold, fairly cold. So I had a shelter, a tent pole, and my overcoat rolled up in the tent pole, and then one of these little shelter halves on the outside. And I was carrying that as we went up through the, because we didn't know where we were going to go or what was going to happen. And we'd been in this defensive position about 2 days, and the Germans were throwing mortar rounds in everyone. But you could tell when they come that they have a particular whistle, and you know about where they're going to hit. And you get so, we were up there, and we hadn't had any defensive positions. We just moved up there on top of this hill. And the Germans, of course, they had that Siegfried Line zeroed in so damn good they could drop a mortar on almost any place they wanted to. And so a mortar come in, and I thought it was going to be, probably twice as far as that corner room from me. And I laid down with my overcoat and rolled up in that roll. And it hit, and I think other guy was injured, but I didn't know I was injured. So I started around rolling the bag to get my overcoat on, and here it's all full of holes. Wow. I still have the overcoat.
Do you?
Yeah. And then, of course, that went through the war, and that other little story that you have there kind of tells most of that story.
Mm-hmm. Were you afraid that you wouldn't come out of the war alive?
Oh, sure. Yeah. See, in my particular company, there's six officers in a rifle company, and we had 12 replacements in the officers in 110 days.
Wow.
You see, a new lieutenant coming in, he hadn't been with the men, and when he says, come on, charge, they say, hell with you, you go first. And that's what happened. And after that, it's tough.
Yeah.
And they're the ones that get shot the quickest, the first one. And he's got to almost has to do that. You can't, it almost has to be that way.
Were you in the rifle division because you had grown up hunting? Or?
No, I don't know. I think they just, whatever they needed, I think they just stuck us in. But now, our men, we lost 38 men out of 150 in that same time. But that's out of 150, not out of 12, out of six.
Yeah.
You know.
So what do you do between the end of the Battle of the Bulge and the end of the war?
Well, we sat pretty much. We were in contact with the Russians there. And this was kind of an interesting little sideline. There was a little river. I can't Muse or something like that. It was only the width of this room a little bit. And the first night, the Russians are caught with us, and they come up in hay racks with horses being pulled. And of course, we had our trucks. And right away, the men come to me and said, "Hey, we can clean those guys up real quick. We don't have to. They aren't very good." So, anyway, we were on one side of this river. They were on the other side, but there was a factory for women's undergarments right there, and I think it was maintained mainly by Jewish women. I'm not sure.
Uh-huh.
And so the Russian soldiers wanted to start coming across the river. So we, about the third days in, we went some men down by the water, and took all the rest of them, put them in a little backyard of a house and held them. Then the officers for the Russian come over and said, "Hey, we're missing a lot of men." "Yeah, we know, we got them." And yeah, well, what I said, "We'll give them back to you, but we don't want you guys at this side of the river." And after that, they stayed over where they belong. But the interesting part, the first night, the Russian kids stood guard for 12 hours from say 6 o'clock at night to 6 o'clock in the morning. Mm-hmm. Our guys stood 4 hours at a time. And we had two guys on each side of the river, about 100 yards apart or so, and they had some. But, of course, they couldn't talk to each other. But the American guy was going to try to make some communicate with him. So he took his Browning automatic rifle and sprayed it along the beach. And the Russian thought that looked pretty good, so he was going to do it too. And he had a Tommy gun. A Russian Tommy gun was quite effective. But what the trouble was, I don't think he'd ever fired it before. Uh-oh. And when all these things, they tend to go up. And the thing went up and killed the guy he was standing guard with. And when those guys come back at 10 o'clock at night, their eyes were wide open. They said, "My God, this guy killed a guy he's standing guard with, and he's got to stand guard with him 9 more hours before he'll get relieved."
Wow.
Scary.
Very.
Yeah.
Very. Do you remember where you were when the war ended?
Yeah, we were with the Russians there. We were sitting there, and one of the guys went down to the Burgermeister in this little town, and more or less demanded a bunch of wine. And so we had about 10 bottles of wine there for the men that night.
You must have been greatly relieved.
Oh yeah. We sure were.
And how long from, I think it was in April of 45, until you got to come home?
I come home in June, I think.
Of 45?
Yeah. I believe it was June.
And you come back to your father's home?
Yep. And my brother went down and picked me up. I just come by bus from Minneapolis. And we stopped, and I saw my dad was out talking to one of the neighbors there, so we come out, and I was wearing my captain's our uniform at that time, and my dad was pretty impressed. He salutes me, El Capitan, he said. It was kind of interesting.
Milt, as you look back on your life, was your participation in the war life-changing for you?
Yeah, I suppose. Yeah, I suppose it was. Yeah.
Can you tell me how?
Well, I guess, it seemed like I always had, I always had a lot of men to deal with. And that Third Army headquarters, motor pool was a big one. Mm-hmm. There were 330 vehicles in that thing.
I saw that.
And that's a lot of stuff. So I had an awful lot of drivers under me. And there was one other officer too. And then the old first sergeant, he had to be, of course, pretty damn good too. But it was quite a different life.
And were you comfortable, as you think back on it, in being in charge, being an officer?
Yeah, I guess I was. I guess I enjoyed most of it. And of course, the guys, I had a lot of fun with the men and with the other officers that you'd run on to. And then we'd have to supply, you know, for the go down to, well, like the chef for the headquarters, he had to have a truck every now and then go down to France someplace and pick up some special things for some of the parties they had. And he'd have to work through me some way, and I benefited too, so.
So you didn't complain too much?
No.
So you're back in the United States. What are your plans? Are you pretty clear on your plans?
Well, let's see. I wanted to finish school, first thing. So I had to go back to school for that fall and winter. And then I graduated then the next June.
In 47.
47, yeah. Then I went right to graduate school after that.
And what was your major when you graduated from South Dakota State?
I had a degree or a major in poultry science and chemistry and a minor in rural sociology.
Really?
Now, that'll sort of throw you, and it did, kind of. But I had taken a class in rural sociology that I liked one time. But isn't maybe quite the right word, but anyway. Anyway, I had to, in order to make money, I had to work at a camp and in the summer, that first summer between there. So I got a job with the 4-H people to go up to one of the 4-H camps that was on Lake Kempeska, which is a fairly big lake up by Watertown. But it was 3 weeks long, and I had to be there every day. So I knew I had to sign up for a 6 weeks class, but I was going to be there 3 weeks out of the six. So I needed to have a class that I figured I could do pretty good in, because I had to keep my average up. I was already I was in reserve already. And so I decided rural sociology. There was a good book that they used, and I knew he used the book right down the line. So I read the book, but I didn't go to class board in 3 weeks out of the six. And I still got an A out of it anyway. But working at that 4-H camp was an experience, I'll tell you.
Now, what does that mean?
Well, we had a director, and we'd these kids would come in from around the state for 3 days each group. They would be there for 3 weeks. We had, of course, good beach, and I was teaching some identification of weeds and trees and stuff, and then I was running the newspaper. And I was doing all kinds of odd jobs around the camp. But we also had the faculty, or if you want to call us faculty, had to put on a skit one night for this thing, this three-day event. So one of our big things was we had this skit, and we had a table with a blanket on it, and they pulled the table out in front of all the kids, and then I come in, and I had this big black ball, glass ball, and I would sit with my back to the audience, and I'd say, "Oh, what is it? What object do you hold?" And I had some kid in the back of the room would hold up a watch or a clock or a billfold or whatever it was. And I'm sitting with my back, and then I'd identify him. And I'd say, Swami, what is this? I couldn't see a damn thing, but the commandant, the head, he had to crawl underneath with that when they brought that table in underneath it under the blanket. And then he would start sticking his head out the side of the blanket and look, and he could see back then. And then he had a bald head, and it was so funny. I'm sitting there with my back, and I could hear these damn kids in the first row started laughing, kind of quietly, you know. And here they could see his bald head come out from this blanket. And each time the blanket, they'd name another, it'd get out farther and farther. Pretty much half the damn crowd knew it. And then but the crowd really enjoyed the heck out of that.
I'll bet. I bet you enjoyed doing it, too.
Yeah, that was... we had to do it, you know, several times for those 3 weeks there.
Yeah.
But when I began to hear those little twitter from these kids, I knew what was happening. I couldn't see a damn thing, of course.
No. So, Milt, how was it that you decided you wanted to pursue your education, that you wanted to go to graduate school?
Well, I think the professors at the department there encouraged me a lot. They said, "You better go to grad school." And I think that's what got it on. Then I started sending in the things, and then I was getting accepted almost any place. I was accepted at Cornell, and the guy came out to see me. And he was
Cornell in New York.
Yeah, and he was a very nice guy, I guess, but somehow I just thought he was so damn tight about everything I did. And so I decided to go to Madison to look at it. And I got to meet the professor there. I kind of enjoyed it. And I remember him saying, "Well, we'll have you back here, Milt." But he may have known something that I didn't never thought about at the time. And that is, he was quite a wheel here with the World's Poultry Science, and he had been down at this thing down in Cleveland in 1938.
Ah, when you had been there.
Yeah, and he knew, I suppose, he might have known that I was placing real high in this judging contest. Mm-hmm. And that might have been what happened. And why? And I liked him always, and so that's why I come to here, to Madison. I didn't know Madison. I'd been through here once, to see the dirt silos. They were trench silos or something. Or but that's the only time I'd ever been in this town.
So you didn't have any regrets about not going to Cornell?
Not really, no. And I'll tell, well, the first thing that really, and I may have said this the other day, that I got in here the 23rd of August, and I wasn't supposed to start till the 1st of September. Mm-hmm. And about the 10th of September, I get a check for $9 and some cents. He signed me up right that minute to the, so he paid me. Of course, $9 did kill the university at that time.
No.
but it made quite an impression on me. It did.
Yeah, I bet it did.
Well, that's...
So was Madison well known for poultry
yes,
science?
Yes, yes. Yeah. And Madison furnished this old helping. His students started a lot of the university science, poultry science departments in the United States.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. He was from Cornell.
Oh, Halpin was?
Yeah, yeah.
At that time when you came to the university, was it more of a land-grant institution than it is today? Did it get a lot of...
No, I think that from a academic as far as health, human health, and many things, university was way up there because... see, most of the vitamins and minerals, a lot of them were really started or developed from here or from people that had been here. Mm-hmm. They swung them. And I was just a damn grad student, and I remember going down to Federation meetings down in Atlantic City. There was all the federated societies met there. And then we'd have a poultry conference, early part, and so a lot of these commercial feed people would come, and they want to talk to me. And they wanted to talk because they figured I'd know a lot about what was going on in Madison and to maybe who's patenting what or this kind of stuff.
Milt, when you came as a graduate student, what was your, did you have a particular interest at that time in some aspect of poultry?
No, I don't think so. No, I don't think I did because, but I'd started working with so many different, first the commercial side of the business, but then these groups that got into, that were identifying vitamins at that time, and the companies that were producing them would come in and want to talk. Mm-hmm. And they didn't talk to me particularly any better than anybody else, but these people respected the people around the country and the commercial concerns and vitamins and chemicals and so on. They knew these people, and they respected what they had to say.
Now, why are you in biochemistry? Your resume says that you get out an MS in biochemistry.
Yeah, yeah. I had a joint major between poultry science and biochem, and my biochem advisor was Elvium, which you maybe have heard of.
Oh, Conrad Elvium.
Yes, he was my advisor.
Really?
Oh, yeah. All the way through. and then his family too. I got to know the two kids and the wife real well too. He was awful good to me. In fact, if he hadn't died, I'd have been better off than I am now, I suppose, because I was thinking of going to another school there one time, and he said, "Oh, Milt, I can always get plenty of stuff for money for you to take care of any experiments you want to do." Then he died. That didn't.
And so that largesse did not continue.
No, but he knew me, and I knew him real well.
So how did you get him as an advisor?
I don't have any idea.
You were just assigned to him, I take it.
Yeah, yeah. But it may be the connection between this Halpin, who was the big wheel in poultry, and Hart in biochem. I don't know. I just don't know. But I. That's where I ended up, and I wasn't too pleased because I knew he was a pretty tough old cool fish, but he was a big iron man, and he did a lot of important things in biochemistry. Elvium did, yeah. And then he became president, of course. Here he was the dean of the graduate school, and Then he became president after that, even.
I did not know he was dean of
graduate school.
So what was your master's thesis?
I think it was, it's something about intestinal microbiology on the organisms in a digestive tract. Mm-hmm. That was one of the aspects of it. I've got a copy at home someplace. I could drag that in sometime, I think.
Yeah, I'd like to see that.
Yeah.
And were you enjoying graduate school?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I sure was. And we had a basketball team, you know. And then I got to know the guys in biochem in this area, too. And one was a guy in particular, was Stan, I can't think of his last name. But anyway, he was quite a, and Elvin was quite interested in it because he had a big project with one of the protein outfits that did different things with leather. And so he had one company that made baseball gloves. And so he would always get a bunch of baseball gloves for us for our ball team.
And when you were working on your master's, did you know you would be going on for a PhD?
No, I didn't. And nobody ever asked me either. They just said, well, you better next week you're going to do this and do that. And that's all there was to it. I never thought much one way or another about it.
Did you know that you were headed toward an academic career?
Yeah, I think I got a inkling because I'd only been here about 6 months. I was on what I called an industrial fellow. And that was considered a pretty good classification at that time, but I don't know why. But anyway, I started, and I had to give a seminar here real early, and the first thing I know, they want me to start teaching, and I was just on this $1,100, but I wasn't. So I started teaching first a short course class in poultry farm management. Then I did that for 30 years, I think. But then they also added another one on turkey management, so I'd have a bunch of kids in that thing next, too. So I was teaching three classes before I ever got my PhD.
Milt, for the record, for historians of the future who might not know what the short course is,
would you talk about
what that is?
That's the farm short course. It's for kids that can't come home to college because they got to work on the farm. And so they stay on the farm until the first week of November about. Then they'd come down here till Christmas, and then Christmas in one session. Then they'd go back home in March or April to work on the farm again. And they could get a short course degree that way after 2-3 years.
I see.
And so there were a lot of them were damn sharp kids. But they just couldn't be missing from the farm.
So could any kid enroll in that short course?
Yes, I think so. And also we had quite a few foreigners come in over here from especially Germany and Japan. Of course, they'd like to come early then. They'd come in August and to learn enough English so they could get a class.
Now, in the short course, these were mostly high school graduates.
Yeah, right. I think mostly, yeah.
Okay.
There were a few older people, too. In fact, one lady just died here a little bit ago. She took my farm short course class. And I was showing them how to kill chickens. And she thought that'd be pretty good, so she buys a bunch of Leghorn hens someplace or other, and she butchers them on the campus somewhere and throws the feathers and guts in a pile, and then they really got nasty with her, and she didn't think she was doing too much wrong, but it didn't go. But she just died here. She was from Poland, but she was a translator for the army. She translated Russian and Polish. And English and German. She knew German too, so they used her a lot for translating.
Milt, did you find that you liked teaching
from
the beginning?
Oh, yeah.
You were not uncomfortable?
No, never. No. See, I was teaching Sunday school when I was just a class when I was still in high school. I'd done a lot of that too there at that time. Yeah.
And you must have been raised Lutheran.
Oh, sure. Is there anything else?
No, I'm married to one. Because I saw that you're active at Bethel Lutheran.
Yeah.
So you go for your PhD.
Yeah.
And again, you're working with LVM, I suppose.
Yeah.
And what was your thesis?
Had to do with some of this stuff on of antibiotics, for instance. We published quite a few papers on antibiotics back in that time. And then I did some work on cecectomy, taking the cecus or the appendix out of a chicken and then measuring the vitamin content of the eggs. So I did some of that kind of stuff too.
According to your CV here, you get your PhD in 1950.
That sounds about, yeah.
And was that a big celebration with your family? Were they?
I don't think there was any celebration about it. No, I don't think so.
Mm-mm. Was your father pleased, do you think, with your advancement in academics?
I don't think so, no. But I think the most impressive thing was when I come home with my captain's bars. I think that's the most important thing.
And are you married by this time?
I got married in 47. So I was, she and my wife come with me down, and she got a job here. And we went to here. Yeah.
And was your wife from South Dakota?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. In fact, her mother was a good friend of my mother.
Oh. So she grew up in the same town? So let's turn now to your career here. You list first that you're an instructor in poultry science, 49 through 51.
Right.
I assume that's the short course?
Well, that was part of it, but I was teaching long course there too at that same thing as an instructor.
Okay, and what was that course?
Well, it was good, just beginning poultry science 101.
And what are the components of that?
Well, we would start out with a little just general stuff, and then we'd go into the various breeds of poultry and the management systems, the egg farmer, the turkey farmer, even a little bit on the duck farmer, because we had a lot of ducks at that time in the state. And then we get into biology, and a lot of nutrition. I gave them a lot of nutrition stuff.
Were the students almost exclusively Wisconsin farm kids?
I would say 80% anyway, yeah.
And what would the other 20% be?
Well, there were some foreign people here quite often. Uh-huh. And then there were some girls, too. We didn't have girls at all, of course. Then we got a few girls, and they were interested in it for going to vet school, I think, more than anything else.
I see. So when you got the job here as instructor, had you been looking anywhere else, Milt, or did you want to stay here?
Well, I tell you, it was so damn funny. I gave this first paper, I've been in about 1950, on antibiotic, and at the poultry science meeting. And I knew I could come back here, but I had three other job offers that same day.
That same day?
Yeah. The different departments around the country, they'd come in and listen, of course. They wanted to, and I had enough BS, I guess, to make it please some people.
So where were those other offers from?
Well, one was Texas, one was Nebraska, and I think Georgia. I can't remember for sure.
Did you consider any of them?
No. No, I liked it here. Uh-huh. And I knew we had the grad school here, that biochem department here was tops. Mm-hmm. It was. And believe me, the poultry people, too, they were well-respected, those guys on the staff here, they were well-respected around the whole damn country. They really were.
And, Milt, explain to me the significance of poultry science in terms of the American culture of the time.
Well, let me give you an example. You may laugh at this, but you probably heard of spinal bifida.
Sure.
Anyway, I published a paper in September of 1950 on the folic acid needs for a chicken to prevent, so they develop nothing but a head and a backbone.
Huh.
And that was 1950. And it took until 1980-something before the medical profession really started adding folic acid to the diets for ladies going to become pregnant.
Huh.
And it is hard to believe that it took that long to get people, because the symptoms were so obvious, and I even used the word embryonic in the publication, in the title of the publication.
And it wasn't picked up because
it's just chickens. Just chickens.
I see. So what could a scientist working in that realm really know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Is that,
well, I
is
think
that
that's
the implied
yeah. I think
assessment?
So. Yeah. Yeah. Now, I have another little story that I can tell you. We had a gal named Beth, and she was a character, but her trademark name for her email was Beth is Best. Well, one day she come in the office. She'd been here 6-8 years. She come in and shut the door, which she never did. And she said, Milt, I got to talk to you. He said, in the last year and a half, I've had 2 abortions. And I want to know what I should do about it. And I said, well, I don't really know, but I showed her this book, and I said, we got folic acid in the lab here. Why don't you make up some capsules for yourself? And she knew how to do that. Put about 30 milligrams or 40 milligrams in each one and take one a day for a while. Well, I didn't hear anything. But about a year later, she has this baby. And she made some fuss to me about it, but she had 2 more children, and I'm not sure I got one this year, but I would get a Christmas card every year with the 3 kids on it, the different ages of, and then when she finally left, the day she left, she said, "You'll never know how much good you've done for me."
Based on your own research and observations.
Well, yeah, that's only my opinion too, maybe. But that was what she's, and I thought that was really interesting to send a picture every year for 20 years or so, showing how the kids were doing.
She wouldn't have them, but for
well, you. Maybe not. I don't know. Well, anyway, but that's the a lot of people don't think that a chicken is an animal.
Really?
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons they don't necessarily want to believe too much what we do.
Work that perhaps comes from a cow or
would
pig
be much better.
Is considered much more substantial.
Oh, yeah. Oh, sure.
Than
sure.
That.
I'm sure. Yeah.
Which comes out of poultry.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think that's
so interesting.
Well, I think it's. I don't know it's true, but I've thought that for a long time.
So you're then promoted to assistant professor in 51.
Yeah.
And when you get that promotion, what goes along with that? Are you
there's
teaching
a little increase.
More courses?
No, I don't think so. I don't think I taught any more. But the assistant and associate And even the full professor, once you've kind of in the, it just comes, they don't do much of anything different about anything, I don't think. I don't think they do.
Are you embarked on a pretty aggressive publishing path at this point?
Oh, yes. Oh, at that time, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I was publishing. Well, you can see that bundle of stuff.
Yes, I could.
But of course, a lot of it was the grad students would write a lot of the publication, and I would make whatever, and then they had, and any other professor they would add their whatever comments they had, and get them to change things or whatever were necessary. But yeah, but it always tend to be a good part of it had to be the work from the student too. Mm-hmm. So sometimes you had to, some of the foreigners you had to rewrite things pretty much, but. A lot of the others you didn't.
And where were you trying to get published in? What were the key journals?
Well, the Poultry Science Journal, of course, got a lot of them. Journal of Nutrition got a lot of them. Biological Sciences got a lot of them. And those would be the ones we used the most. Proceedings Society Experimental in Biology and Medicine, we used PROCSOC, we called it. We used that a lot, too. Uh-huh. That was a little faster.
You're not having graduate PhD students as an assistant, are you?
Not now.
No. Back then, an assistant.
They would be assistants at the labs. Yeah, yeah. And a lot of them helped me teach the classes. They would help with the lab and all this kind of stuff too. Yeah.
Do you have tenure yet at this point?
I think tenure come when I got to be the associate. I think I had tenure then.
And was that difficult to get?
No, I never did a damn thing about it. But I think maybe Halpin probably did. I don't know.
Oh, so you just got notified one day that you now have tenure?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's certainly different from how it's done today.
Yeah, I guess so. I'm sure I never prepared anything for anything.
So what are your personal research interests at this point in the mid-50s?
Well, we were working mainly a lot of on amino acid type things, where the amino acids in the protein, we were seeing which ones were what are most important and compounds that were high or low in them, and we were doing a lot of that. And then we got into some of this stuff on different housing arrangements, the cage floors and that stuff. We did some of that.
Now, what does that mean?
Well, a lot of the chickens now are raised on wire cages so the droppings fall through.
Right.
And then still a lot of them, of course, are still in, with bedding and stuff. But we did publish on that. And then we published papers on water consumption of chickens. Now, that sounds pretty elementary, but it's quite a factor because when people start talking about medication and medicating in the water, they really kind of need to know about how much those damn chickens drink. Hmm. To see what level they can tolerate and what level they need of these things.
Milt, are you at this point speaking in the state a lot to groups of farmers?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And then a lot of state, too, because they know, see, not because of me, but Wisconsin had a real reputation in the poultry area for all over the country. Huh. So I used to go to a lot of nutrition schools and talk to them, different places around. Now Mexico used to have me come down for a nutrition school about every 5 years there too, and then I've talked to I've been several different countries giving spiels on this or that.
At this point in American culture, has chicken moved to the top in terms of something that's better for you to eat than red beef?
Oh, I some people say that, I don't know. See, generally speaking, the chicken is a little bit lower in fat than most of the other meat.
Point in American culture is chicken. Has chicken moved to the top in terms of something that's better for you to eat than red beef?
Oh, some people say that. I don't know. See, they, generally speaking, the chicken is a little bit lower in fat than most of the other meats, but I don't know how important that is. But there are people that believe that. I'm not too sure I do. But there are a lot of people who believe that.
I'm going to stop eating chicken then. I mean, I love chicken, but I eat a lot because I think it's better for me.
Well, I don't know if it is or not, but like pork. There's quite a little fat in it, and yet I like pork. And I eat a lot of chicken too. But then I got big with one of the extension guys in barbecuing chicken around. And we used to barbecue up to 3,000 birds, halves and birds in one day sometimes.
Really?
Oh, that'd pit the hell of a long pit, and you have to work your butt off. But
and why did you do that?
Well, the extension guy talked me into helping him.
And this was to illustrate to?
Well, it was, yeah, from it was illustration. Some was helping some outfit, some school or church or something, make some money on selling them.
I see.
In the 50s, I just barbecued an awful lot. Just an awful lot of stuff. And I worked with one of the extension guys just an awful lot. And we.
Who was that?
Hayes, Barry Hayes.
Okay.
He was an old extension guy from a word way, way, way back. And his wife, was she a character? She really could snap a guy off. they were a wonderful couple, and they had some kids too of their own, and they were. I've had so much fun with people, it's hard to believe.
Yeah, I can believe that. So, you're now a professor, full professor in 57. Does your administrative work change, or do you start doing more for the department?
No, I think I worked an awful lot there at those times with the poultry club, and then that was a big thing. Then there were some times early where somebody thought I was supposed to be chairman of the department, but I wasn't too eager about it, and so nothing to come up at that time. But that got me into. Somewhat later before I got into that stuff, I wasn't looking for anything extra, but I just wanted to keep kind of going along as best I could.
Uh huh.
Yeah.
Where are you housed at this point?
I was at University Houses.
I mean your office.
Oh, well, we had, my office was in the old poultry building up on the University Avenue.
Was where?
You know where the wharf building is?
Yes.
Next door, that's part of the chicken yards there.
Oh, I see.
On the University Avenue there.
Okay.
Then I was down below at just a T20 that was right below that old armory building there, where I think there's still a military group in there. The Enzyme Institute is a little closer to the main part of the capital than the Enzyme Institute.
Uh-huh.
And that's gone now. And there's another nice bit. It's a student clinic, I think, there now. But then we went up to Hiram Smith. That's the ones on top of the hill, next to where the soil. You know the soil, where the bacteriology or soil stability is right behind that.
Oh, I see.
It's that old-fashioned building, built for $45,000, I think, in 1889 or something like that.
Yeah,
in that order, and we had second floor there for a while. Then we moved into the Animal Science Building, which is down where we are now.
Okay, so this must have been built in the 80s, maybe?
Probably somewhat earlier than that. If I could make a guess, 73, but that might not be right. I don't know. But I think there's a thing on the outside of the building that has the date on it.
Okay.
But it was actually the oleo tax made this building.
Really?
Yeah.
And I'm vaguely familiar with oleo, but talk for the record about
that. Well, that's the oleo margarine, and they had a tax on it because first we didn't want it to come into Wisconsin because that was bad stuff, you see. And so there was tax on it, and then they used that tax to build this animal science building, and I suppose some other things too. But you know, the people here, I remember when I first was in grad school, one of the food science guys was showing us a bag with that little red thing in the middle of it, and you take and break that bag and then squish it, and get the color all just so it looks like butter. Well, that was part of it. Then now they don't have to. It's done. They don't have to do it in the bag anymore. It's already done for you. But and I think maybe it's in the early 70s, but I think it may show out there. Then I've been in this building up on the 10th floor or down on the main floor for different times over the years.
So by the early 60s, what is your research program?
I don't remember exactly. I'm afraid the books will show it pretty well about what is going on.
Okay.
Yeah.
This back on.
You're good.
Okay. Milt, we're resuming the interview, and you just got some of your records covering your research program in the early 60s up to the 1970. Can you give us a sense of the key projects you were working on and identify the subjects from your records?
Yeah, I think I can. Anyway, I see there's one here from 1960. This is in Spanish, but it's on the influence of corn on the pigment and the coloring of the eggs. And that had to do a lot. Then there's another one based on the various books or prescriptions we use for how much protein, how much fat, and so on, and some of the diets and that stuff. Then his dietary protein and energy levels was an important thing, because the less energy you put in, that is more high fibrous stuff, to more protein you need, because they're eating so much more of the other stuff that they need the protein as well.
Uh-huh.
And so that was. Then I see here's one on amino acids and the laying hen. There are certain amino acids we need specifically to watch for, because some of the protein feeds we use tend to be deficient in one or more of these amino acids.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. And then I see another one on arsenic. Here's possible effect of arsenic acid in a hen's diet and hatchability of eggs at high altitudes.
Huh.
I don't know why I got messing with that, but I did. So, and then here's lysine, arginine. That's a requirement. That's one of the amino acids for laying hens. And then, now here's another one that's quite different. Different levels of vitamin A, APO8 carotenal, and alfalfa to make the color, yolk color right in eggs. And that was one of the things that a lot of interest in, and there still is today. In fact, you see these ads now that show eggs. They always got a really nice yellow color to them, because that people have the idea that it's healthier, and it may or may not be, but it looks like it's healthier if it's nice and yellow
than
the yolk.
Okay, I have always assumed that the darker the yolk, the better the egg is.
Yeah, that's the darker color. Yes. Well,
is that true or?
It would be true for the amount of vitamin A or carotene in it. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, but maybe you got all the carotene you need anyway. Well, then I see I did one here on random sample testing throughout the United States, and this was a story about the random sample takes in so many birds from a particular breeding, and then they run them for a year, laying eggs, see how many eggs they lay on average for this flock. It's a pretty standard technique. Pretty standard technique. Now here's one that goes back quite a ways. How about the farm mixing for your farm? This is on whether you should mix your feed at home or you need to buy it all ready mixed. And this is people used to think about that. And I think nowadays, I think sometimes really the big units, they mix their own. But most of the smaller farms, they probably buy their feed already mixed up for them different.
Milt, I have to ask you an uninformed question.
Yeah.
My mother had a grandmother who lived in the country in Oregon in the 1920s.
Okay.
And every Sunday, they all went out there for a big roast chicken dinner. So decades later, when I'm growing up in the 50s and 60s, my mother would serve chicken, but she always said the chicken wasn't nearly as flavorful as the chicken that she remembered as a child.
And you know, she might be right.
And she thought it was because the chicken just ate whatever was in the yard. So I'm just curious if there's any validity to that or if it's just mythology.
No, I think and we've done some experiments with that to see what kind of flavors we get. And generally speaking, the older a chicken, the more flavor it has. You can argue whether you like that kind of flavor or not, but there's more taste to an older chicken than to a younger one. And I think it goes back to the bacteria in the gut, pretty much. They help determine what flavors go into the meat.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if they know what they're doing, but they're working at it.
Oh, interesting.
So white meat tends to be less flavorful than dark meat.
Uh-huh.
Because it just works that way. So if you want the most flavorful meat on a chicken, you should get it off the thigh or the drumstick and not from the breast.
What about this current movement on organic foods? Is there any scientific basis for that?
There's no scientific basis for just the organic part. However, the chickens that are raised organically usually are raised to an older age than the commercial type birds, and so therefore they tend to have more flavor.
Huh.
But of course you're paying through the nose too for that, but they tend to have more flavor.
Okay. Well, it was a digression. I was just interested.
Yeah. Well, those are the kind of things we were trying to do in the early 60s there. I see I got another one here on zinc metabolism for chickens and calcium and zinc on metabolic stuff too. And it's all those things, we were working on those things way, way back there, and some of those things keep, a new interest comes up for some special little thing someplace or by somebody, and next thing you know, you're doing some of almost the same kind of things you were doing 20 years before.
Who's driving the interest in further poultry research? Is it industry? Is it coming from large-scale farms? Is it coming from small farmers?
I don't know whether the scaling of a farm up from smaller to larger will affect anything, but on the average, I assume that the small farm has a less regulated program than for the large units, because they have to go in and out and pretty specifically at different times. And so I suppose there's a possibility that you get a chicken from a smaller unit, a little older, and therefore more flavorful than from a very standardized, high production type unit.
Were there in the 60s the starting of the very large corporate chicken farming like Tyson and I don't know who all?
Yeah, there would be some of those around. The idea of a large farm is quite interesting, because there used to be a big farm in southern Wisconsin called the Bella Will Farms, and there was a guy who had a lot of money in his day, but he had a big, some kind of a factory thing in Chicago, but he also had this nice home and a lot of land up north in the southern part of Wisconsin, and he developed a pretty large broiler farm there, plant there, and all the birds were kept in cages, but he had his own processing, and he had a lot of help working around there, and was pretty progressive in some of the things he was coming up with, his son was Will. And Val was his daughter, I believe, in the Valley. That's where the Valley Will Farm come from. But anyway, I used to go down there once in a great while, see them, help them a little bit maybe.
And how much work like that are you doing in the state now?
Well, not too much, I guess. And one of the things I do feel kind of proud of is that I got to know the feed dealers in the state way, quite a while back. And in the 70s, I started meeting with some of the presidents of the feed companies around Madison for lunch. And we'd go, two, three times a year. And that was in the 70s. Then time goes on, I retired, but they still kept meeting. And so I meet with the presidents of the feed companies around Madison now, even yet. I've been retired since 87. About two or three times a year, we have lunch together someplace or other around in one of the towns around Madison. And we get to talk about a lot of the stuff that I don't know if we make any good decisions or not, but we still talk. So I still meet with them three, four times a year.
And what are the topics of discussion?
Well, a lot about some new ingredient that they can buy, or there's some mineral supplement that doesn't do in the bell form and that's been diluted, or those kind of things we talk about. And then it's getting so now we have two of the husbands have died, of these fellows, and the wives, they still come to our meetings, so they come to it. So I'm afraid, I'm not certainly afraid of, but I think it's getting to be more social than anything else. But we still meet, and it's fun for me.
Do you yourself these days keep up with all of the poultry science? Do you read?
I read some, but I don't read as much as I used to. I still get the journals, and I do look at them. And I still give an award at the Nutritional Society for the best paper that deals with poultry and the nutrition.
What are you teaching at this time in the 60s and 70s? Have you added any new courses?
No, I think the labs have tend to get somewhat more technical than they used to be, you're getting it so the students are learning more procedures to do things than we did when I first started teaching. And I think it's probably in the long run it's better for them than what we did.
And from the 60s, 70s, 80s, is the enrollment of your classes growing? Is there an increasing demand for the knowledge about poultry?
I don't think so. I don't think there's any increase the now right now we're running at the university right now we're running classes on poultry in the summer because not many universities teach much about the specialty areas anymore, and so we have classes that meet in the summers here, and they can get partially degrees with that, but they come from many parts of the country to come up here for this program. In fact, tonight I'm going to be visiting with a guy who is going down to Brazil, and he and some of the people think it'd be kind of if he'd have a chance to talk to me. So I'm meeting with tonight with him to talk about some of the poultry stuff down in Brazil.
And would you say that there's more interest in poultry cultivation elsewhere in the world than in the United States?
Well, there's getting to be more than there used to be, but a lot of the countries didn't mess with it at all. But Brazil has been pretty active in pretty fundamental. They've been doing pretty good for some years down there, and there's quite a poultry operations in Mexico too, and of course Canada, and even in Colombia, South America. There's really big units that operate there, mm-hmm. and they're pretty effective, I think.
Now, I've noticed on your resume you have several major overseas activities during the course of your career. Can you talk about those, how they came about, and what you did?
Well, I don't know how some of them come about. One of the first ones was I won some award someplace or other that I could have money to go on some foreign trip, so I decided to go to Japan. And I went over there and visited with a lot of the commercial people in the poultry, not necessarily just the poultry area alone, but they were doing different things where they had poultry or the chemicals used in the poultry industry involved and so on. So I would give a whole series of talks over there about that and talk to the people about. And I went to many of their labs and stuff over there just to see what they were doing, and they were wanting to talk about, of course, what we were doing too.
So why and how did you pick Japan?
Well, I knew they had a pretty good, a lot of chemicals industry was a pretty active over there at that time. And so I thought it'd be fun, and I thought I learned quite a lot. I also got a grad student or two afterwards too from there. So they were pretty progressive in many areas. You kind of think of sometimes of being they're behind the eight ball, but they are not behind in a lot of things. Japan was really, really, really yes, but and it still is.
Was chicken a major food in Japan?
Well, there's a lot of it eaten. When I was there, they were preparing some things that I didn't think looked too good. They were taking pieces of skin from chicken and rolling it up and putting it in some batter and then deep frying it, and it tasted pretty good, but I didn't think it was too nutritious.
And when was that? Was that in the 60s?
Oh, early 60s, I think. Yeah. Yeah. Then I used to go to Mexico about every 5 years or so and give a couple of talks to people who are down in Mexico City around the university there. And I think I've already mentioned going down to Colombia for 6 months.
You did mention it, but I wanted to hear more about that because that seems to be related to the Rockefeller Foundation.
Yeah, right.
And so what were you hired for? What were you supposed to be doing?
I was supposed to be helping them set up a poultry experiment station thing, and for the country, and which we did. They had a facility that they'd start building. They had built part of it up before I got there. And then when I got there, we got chickens in and started doing experiments. Then we had a pretty good chemical lab hooked up with it too, so we could get those kind of results in pretty quick, and Then we also found out that some of the industry people were thinking about things too, and so sometimes they would get in there with some things that before we ever got in. But in general, we kept it at a pretty good level, so it didn't bother anything. But the industry was also, there were some pretty sharp guys that were dealing with that stuff too. They knew what they were up to. And then it was fun. I'd go out to give talks, and of course they'd have a translator translate it into Spanish. And somebody, almost every dang meeting, somebody would get up and correct the translator.